explicitly targeting the unresponsive audience, the state enlisted popular Dallas Cowboys football players to participate in television ads in which they collected litter, smashed beer cans in their bare hands, and growled, "Don't mess with Texas." Other spots included popular singers, such as Willie Nelson. People can now get all kinds of "Don't mess with Texas" products, from decals to shirts to coffee mugs. One popular decal offers patriotic colors reflecting both the U.S. flag and, perhaps more important, the Texas flag, figure 3.1. About 95% of Texans now know this slogan, and in 2006, "Don't mess with Texas" was voted America's favorite slogan by a landslide and was honored with a parade down New York City's Madison Avenue. We are not making this up, only in America, to be sure. More to the point, within the first year of the campaign, litter in the state had been reduced by a remarkable 29%. In its first 6 years, there was a 72% reduction in visible roadside litter. All this happened not through mandates, threats, or coercion, but through a creative nudge. The spotlight effect. One reason why people expend so much effort conforming to social norms and fashions is that they think that others are closely paying attention to what they are doing. If you wear a suit to a social event where everyone else has gone casual, you feel like everyone is looking at you funny and wondering why you are such a geek. If you are subject to such fears, here is a possibly comforting thought. They aren't really paying as much attention to you as you think. Tom Jelovich and his colleagues have demonstrated that people fall prey to what he calls the spotlight effect. In a typical experiment, Jelovich's team started by doing some research about which entertainer would be most unhip to display on the front of a t-shirt. This research was conducted in the late 1990s, and the winner of this dubious honor was the singer Barry Manilow. When a student arrived for the experiment, he was told to put on a t-shirt with Barry Manilow's picture prominently displayed on the front. The student was then asked to join another group of students who were busy filling out questionnaires. After a minute or so, the experimenter returned and told the student wearing the t-shirt that he now realized he wanted him to participate in a different study. The student and the experimenter then left the room. At this point, the student was asked to guess how many of the other students in the room would be able to identify who was on his t-shirt. The average guess was a bit less than half, 46%. In fact, only 21% of the group could say who was pictured on his t-shirt. The moral is that people are paying less attention to you than you believe. If you have a stain on your shirt, don't worry, they probably won't notice. But in part because people do think that everyone has their eyes fixed on them, they conform to what they think people expect. Cultural change, political change, and unpredictability. Might culture and politics be affected by conformity? Might companies be able to make money by enlisting conformity? Consider some evidence involving music downloads. Matthew Salganik and his co-authors, 2006, created an artificial music market with 14,341 participants who were visitors to a website popular with young people. The participants were given a list of previously unknown songs from unknown bands. They were asked to listen to a brief selection of any songs that interested them, to decide which songs, if any, to download, and to assign a rating to the songs they chose. About half of the participants were asked to make their decisions independently, based on the names of the bands and the songs and their own judgment about the quality of the music. The other half could see how many times each song had been downloaded by other participants. Each participant in this second group was also randomly assigned to one or another of eight possible worlds, each of which evolved on its own. Those in any particular world could see only the downloads in their own world. A key question was whether people would be affected by the choices of others, and whether different music would become popular in the different worlds. Were people nudged by what other people did? There is not the slightest doubt. In all eight worlds, individuals were far more likely to download songs that had been previously downloaded in significant numbers, and far less likely to download songs that had not been as popular. Most strikingly, the success of songs was quite unpredictable, and the songs that did well or poorly in the control group, where people did not see other people's judgments, could perform very differently in the social influence worlds. In those worlds, most songs could become popular or unpopular, with much depending on the choices of the first downloaders. The identical song could be a hit or a failure simply because other people, at the start, were seen to choose to have downloaded it or not. In many domains, people are tempted to think, after the fact, that an outcome was entirely predictable and that the success of a musician, an actor, an author, or a politician was inevitable in the light of his or her skills and characteristics. Beware of that temptation. Small interventions and even coincidences at a key stage can produce large variations in the outcome. Today's hot singer is probably indistinguishable from dozens and even hundreds of equally talented performers whose names you've never heard. We can go further. Most of today's governors are hard to distinguish from dozens or even hundreds of politicians whose candidacies badly fizzled. The effect of social influences may or may not be deliberately planned by particular people. For a vivid and somewhat hilarious example of how social influences can affect beliefs, even if no one plans anything, consider the Seattle windshield pitting epidemic. In late March 1954, a group of people in Bellingham, Washington noticed some tiny holes or pits on their windshields. Local police speculated that the pits had resulted from the actions of vandals using BBs or buckshot. Soon thereafter, a few people in cities south of Bellingham reported similar damage to their windshields. Within 2 weeks, the apparent work of vandals had gone even further south, to the point where 2,000 cars were reported as damaged, these evidently not the work of vandals. The threat approached Seattle. The Seattle newspapers duly reported the risk in mid-April, and soon thereafter, several reports of windshield pits came to the attention of local police. Before long, those reports reached epidemic proportions, leading to intense speculation about what on earth or elsewhere could possibly be the cause. Geiger counters found no radioactivity. Some people thought that some odd atmospheric event must have been responsible. Others invoked sound waves and a possible shift in the Earth's magnetic field. Still others pointed to cosmic rays from the sun. By April 16th, no fewer than 3,000 windshields in the Seattle area were reported to have been pitted, and Seattle's mayor promptly wrote the governor and President Eisenhower. What appeared to be a localized outbreak of vandalism in damaged auto windshields and windows in the northern part of Washington state has now spread throughout the Puget Sound area. Urge appropriate federal and state agencies be instructed to cooperate with local authorities on emergency basis. In response, the governor created a committee of scientists to investigate this ominous and startling phenomenon. Their conclusion? The damage, such as it was probably the result of normal driving conditions in which small objects strike the windshields of cars. A later investigation, supporting the scientists' conclusion, found that brand new cars lacked pits. The eventual judgment was that the pits had been there all along, but no one had noticed them until now. You might have a look at your car right now, if you've had it for a while. There's probably a pit or two, or more. The Seattle windshield pitting epidemic was an extreme example of unintentional social nudging, but every day we are influenced by people who are not trying to influence us. Most of us are affected by the eating habits of our eating companions, whatever their intentions. As we have said, obesity is contagious. You're more likely to be overweight if you have a lot of overweight friends. An especially good way to gain weight is to have dinner with other people. On average, those who eat with one other person eat about 35% more than they do when they are alone. Members of a group of four eat about 75% more. Those in groups of seven or more eat 96% more. We are also greatly influenced by consumption norms within the relevant group. A light eater eats much more in a group of heavy eaters. A heavy eater will show more restraint in a light eating group. The group average thus inserts a significant influence. But there are gender differences as well. Women often eat less on dates, men tend to eat a lot more, apparently with the belief that women are impressed by a lot of manly eating. Note to men, they aren't. So if you want to lose some weight, look for a thin colleague to go to lunch with, and don't finish the food on her plate. If you find yourself nudged by your friend's eating choices, it is unlikely to be because one or another friend decided to nudge you. At the same time, social influences are often used strategically. In particular, advertisers are entirely aware of the powers of social influences. Frequently, they emphasize that most people prefer their own product, or that growing numbers of people are switching from another brand, which was yesterday's news, to their own, which represents the future. They try to nudge you by telling you what most people are now doing. Candidates for public office or political parties do the same thing. They emphasize that most people are turning to their preferred candidates, hoping that the very statement can make itself true. Nothing is worse than a perception that voters are leaving a candidate in droves. Indeed, a perception of that kind helped to account for the Democratic nomination of John Kerry in 2004. When Democrats shifted from Howard Dean to John Kerry, it was not because each Democratic voter made an independent judgment on Kerry's behalf. It was in large part because of a widespread perception that other people were flocking to Kerry. Duncan Watts's amusing account, 2004, is worth quoting at length. A few weeks before the Iowa caucuses, Kerry's campaign seemed dead, but then he unexpectedly won Iowa, then New Hampshire, and then primary after primary. How did this happen? When everyone is looking to someone else for an opinion, trying, for example, to pick the Democratic candidate they think everyone else will pick, it's possible that whatever information other people might have gets lost, and instead we get a cascade of imitation that, like a stampeding herd, can start for no apparent reason and subsequently go in any direction with equal likelihood. We think of ourselves as autonomous individuals, each driven by our internal abilities and desires, and therefore solely responsible for our own behavior, particularly when it comes to voting. No voter ever admits, even to herself, that she chose Kerry because he won New Hampshire. Social nudges as choice architecture. The general lesson is clear. If choice architects want to shift behavior and to do so with a nudge, they might simply inform people about what other people are doing. Sometimes the practices of others are surprising, and hence people are much affected by learning what they are. Consider four examples. Conformity and tax compliance. In the context of tax compliance, a real-world experiment conducted by officials in Minnesota produced big changes in behavior. Groups of taxpayers were given four kinds of information. Some were told that their taxes went to various good works, including education, police protection, and fire protection. Others were threatened with information about the risks of punishment for non-compliance. Others were given information about how they might get help if they were confused or uncertain about how to fill out their tax forms. Still others were just told that more than 90% of Minnesotans already complied in full with their obligations under the tax law. Only one of these interventions had a significant effect on tax compliance, and it was the last. Apparently, some taxpayers are more likely to violate the law because of a misperception, plausibly based on the availability of media or other accounts of cheaters, that the level of compliance is pretty low. When informed that the actual compliance level is high, they become less likely to cheat. It follows that either desirable or undesirable behavior can be increased, at least to some extent, by drawing public attention to what others are doing. Note to political parties. If you would like to increase turnout, please do not lament the large numbers of people who fail to vote. Preserving petrified wood. In many contexts, of course, the incidence of undesirable behavior is high. This unhappy fact seems to be a real obstacle to change. If people follow one another, we might end up with a vicious cycle or even a spiral. Is it nonetheless possible to nudge people in better directions? An ingenious study suggests an affirmative answer, and it reinforces the view that the specific framing of the problem can have a powerful effect. The study was conducted in the Petrified Forest National Park in Arizona, where some visitors like to take souvenir samples home with them, a practice that threatens the very existence of the park. Signs at the park implore people not to take samples away. The question at issue is what the signs should say. The investigators, led by Robert Cialdini, the great guru of social influence who is a professor down the road in Tempe, were pretty sure that the signs currently being used in the park could be improved. So we arranged an experiment. In all the conditions of the experiment, pieces of petrified wood were scattered along a trail, tempting visitors to take something with them. At two-hour intervals, the language on the sign along the trail was varied. Some signs, similar to those currently used in the park, stressed how bad the problem was. Many past visitors have removed the petrified wood from the park, changing the natural state of the petrified forest. Other signs emphasized an injunctive norm. Please don't remove the petrified wood from the park in order to preserve the natural state of the petrified forest. Cialdini's theory predicted that the positive, injunctive norm would be more effective than the negative, informational one. This prediction was confirmed. Socializing non-drinking. A related example is the social norms approach, which tries to reduce drinking and other undesirable activities. Consider, for instance, the problem of alcohol abuse by, mostly underage, college students. A survey by the Harvard School of Public Health found that about 44% of college students engaged in binge drinking in the 2-week period preceding the survey. This is, of course, a problem, but a clue to how to correct it lies in the fact that most students believe that alcohol abuse is far more pervasive than it actually is. Misperceptions of this kind result in part from the availability heuristic. Incidents of alcohol abuse are easily recalled, and the consequence is to inflate perceptions. College students are influenced by their beliefs about what other college students do, and hence alcohol abuse will inevitably increase if students have an exaggerated sense of how much other students are drinking. Alert to the possibility of changing behavior by emphasizing the statistical reality, many public officials have tried to nudge people in better directions. Montana, for example, has adopted a large-scale educational campaign, one that has stressed the fact that strong majorities of citizens of Montana do not drink. One advertisement attempts to correct misperceived norms on college campuses by asserting, most, 81%, of Montana college students have 4 or fewer alcoholic drinks each week. Montana applies the same approach to cigarette smoking with an advertisement suggesting that, most, 70%, of Montana teens are tobacco-free. The strategy has produced big improvements in the accuracy of social perceptions and also statistically significant decreases in smoking. Smiles, frowns, and saving energy. Social nudges can also be used to decrease energy use. To see how, consider a study of the power of social norms involving nearly 300 households in San Marcos, California. All of the households were informed about how much energy they had used in previous weeks. They were also given accurate information about the average consumption of energy by households in their neighborhood. The effects on behavior were both clear and striking. In the following weeks, the above-average energy users significantly decreased their energy use. The below-average energy users significantly increased their energy use. The latter finding is called a boomerang effect, and it offers an important warning. If you want to nudge people into socially desirable behavior, do not, by any means, let them know that their current actions are better than the social norm. But here is an even more interesting finding. About half of the households were given not merely descriptive information, but also a small, nonverbal signal that their energy consumption was socially approved or socially disapproved. More specifically, those households that consumed more than the norm received an unhappy emoticon, see Figure 3.2a, whereas those that consumed less than the norm received a happy emoticon, like Figure 3.2b. Unsurprisingly, but significantly, the big energy users showed an even larger decrease when they received an unhappy emoticon. The more important finding was that when below-average energy users received the happy emoticon, the boomerang effect completely disappeared. When they were merely told that their energy use was below average, they felt that they had some room to increase consumption, but when the informational message was combined with an emotional nudge, they didn't adjust their use upward. Many people, including Republicans and Democrats alike, are arguing for energy conservation on grounds of national security, economic growth, and environmental protection. To promote energy conservation, a great deal can be done with well-chosen social nudges. We will have more to say about how choice architecture can be used to help the environment later. Priming. Thus far, we have been focusing on people's attention to the thoughts and behavior of other people. Closely related work shows the power of priming. Priming refers to the somewhat mysterious workings of the automatic system of the brain. Research shows that subtle influences can increase the ease with which certain information comes to mind. Imagine playing a word association game with Homer Simpson, and you will get the idea. Sometimes the merest hint of an idea or concept will trigger an association that can stimulate an action. These primes occur in social situations, and their effects can be surprisingly powerful. In surveys, people are often asked whether they are likely to engage in certain behavior, to vote, to lose weight, to purchase certain products. Those who engage in surveys want to catalog behavior, not to influence it. But social scientists have discovered an odd fact. When they measure people's intentions, they affect people's conduct. The mere measurement effect refers to the finding that when people are asked what they intend to do, they become more likely to act in accordance to their answers. This finding can be found in many contexts. If people are asked whether they intend to eat certain foods, to diet, or to exercise, their answers to the question will affect their behavior. In our parlance, the mere measurement effect is a nudge, and it can be used by private or public nudgers. Campaign officials want to encourage their supporters to vote. How can they do that? One obvious method is to emphasize the stakes. Another is to decrease the cost and burdens by making it easier for people to get to the polls. But there is another way. It turns out that if you ask people, the day before the election, whether they intend to vote, you can increase the probability of their voting by as much as 25%. Or suppose that the goal is to increase new purchases of a certain product, such as cell phones or automobiles. A study of a nationally representative sample of more than 40,000 people asked a simple question. Do you intend to buy a new car within the next 6 months? The very question increased purchase rates by 35%. Or suppose that an official wants to encourage people to take steps to improve their own health. With respect to health-related behavior, significant changes can be produced by measuring people's intentions. If people are asked how often they expect to floss their teeth in the next week, they floss more. If people are asked whether they intend to consume fatty foods in the next week, they consume less in the way of fatty foods. The nudge provided by asking people what they intend to do can be accentuated by asking them when and how they plan to do it. This insight falls into the category of what the great psychologist Kurt Lewin called channel factors, a term he used for small influences that could either facilitate or inhibit certain behaviors. Think about the channel as similar to the path a river takes after the spring snowmelt. The path can be determined by seemingly tiny changes in the landscape. For people, Lewin argued that similarly tiny factors can create surprisingly strong inhibitors to behavior that people want to take. Often we can do more to facilitate good behavior by removing some small obstacle than by trying to shove people in a certain direction. An early illustration of Lewin's idea was produced by Leventhal, Singer, and Jones, 1965, on the campus of Yale University. The subjects were Yale seniors who were given some persuasive education about the risks of tetanus and the importance of going to the health center to receive an inoculation. Most of the students were convinced by the lecture and said that they planned to go get the shot, but these good intentions did not lead to much action. Only 3% actually went and got the shot. Other subjects were given the same lecture but were also given a copy of a campus map with the location of the health center circled. They were then asked to look at their weekly schedules, make a plan for when they would go and get the shot, and look at the map and decide what route they would take. With these nudges, 28% of the students managed to show up and get their tetanus shot. Notice that this manipulation was very subtle. The students were all seniors and surely knew where the health center was located. Yale is not a huge campus, and they were not given an actual appointment. Still, 9 times as many students got shots, illustrating the potential power of channel factors. Slightly broadening these findings, social scientists have found that they can prime people into certain forms of behavior by offering simple and apparently irrelevant cues. It turns out that if certain objects are made visible and salient, people's behavior can be affected. Objects characteristic of business environments, such as briefcases and boardroom tables, make people more competitive, less cooperative, and less generous. Smells matter too. Mere exposure to the scent of an all-purpose cleaner makes people keep their environment cleaner while they eat. In most cases, people were not consciously aware of the effect of the cue on their behavior. Or consider this one. People's judgments about strangers are affected by whether they are drinking iced coffee or hot coffee. Those given iced coffee are more likely to see other people as more selfish, less sociable, and, well, colder than those who were given hot coffee. This, too, happens quite unconsciously. The 3 social influences that we have emphasized, information, peer pressure, and priming, can easily be enlisted by private and public nudgers. As we shall see, both business and governments can use the power of social influence to promote many good and bad causes. Chapter 4. When do we need a nudge? We have seen that people perform amazing feats but also commit ditzy blunders. What's the best response? Choice architecture and its effects cannot be avoided, and so the short answer is an obvious one. Call it the golden rule of libertarian paternalism. Offer nudges that are most likely to help and least likely to inflict harm. A slightly longer answer is that people will need nudges for decisions that are difficult and rare, for which they do not get prompt feedback, and when they have trouble translating aspects of the situation into terms that they can easily understand. In this chapter, we try to put some flesh on these points. We begin by specifying the kinds of situations in which people are least likely to make good choices. We then turn to questions about the potential magic of markets and ask whether and when free markets and open competition will tend to exacerbate rather than mitigate the effects of human frailty. The key point here is that for all their virtues, markets often give companies a strong incentive to cater to, and profit from, human frailties rather than to try to eradicate them or to minimize their effects. Fraught choices. Suppose you are told that a group of people will have to make some choice in the near future. You are the choice architect. You are trying to decide how to design the choice environment, what kinds of nudges to offer, and how subtle the nudges should be. What do you need to know to design the best possible choice environment? Benefits now, costs later. We have seen that predictable problems arise when people must make decisions that test their capacity for self-control. Many choices in life, such as whether to wear a blue shirt or a white one, lack important self-control elements. Self-control issues are most likely to arise when choices and their consequences are separated in time. At one extreme are what might be called investment goods, such as exercise, flossing, and dieting. For these goods, the costs are borne immediately, but the benefits are delayed. For investment goods, most people err on the side of doing too little. Although there are some exercise nuts and flossing freaks, it seems safe to say that not many people are resolving on New Year's Eve to floss less next year and to stop using the exercise bike so much. At the other extreme are what might be called sinful goods. Smoking, alcohol, and jumbo chocolate donuts are in this category. We get the pleasure now and suffer the consequences later. Again, we can use the New Year's resolution test. How many people vow to smoke more cigarettes, drink more martinis, or have more chocolate donuts in the morning next year? Both investment goods and sinful goods are prime candidates for nudges. Most non-anorexic people do not need any special encouragement to eat another brownie, but they could use some help exercising more. Degree of difficulty. Nearly everyone over the age of 6 can tie shoelaces, play a respectable game of tic-tac-toe, and spell the word cat. But only a few of us can tie a decent bow tie, play a masterly game of chess, or spell, much less pronounce, the name of psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Of course, we learn to cope with the harder problems. We can buy a pre-tied bow tie, read a book about chess, and look up the spelling of Csikszentmihalyi on the web, then copy and paste every time we have to use the name. We use spell checkers and spreadsheets to help with harder problems. But many problems in life are quite difficult, and often there is no technology as easy as a spell checker available to help. We are more likely to need more help picking the right mortgage than choosing the right loaf of bread. Frequency. Even hard problems become easier with practice. Both of us have managed to learn how to serve a tennis ball into the service court with reasonable regularity, and in Sunstein's case, even velocity, but it took some time. The first time people try to execute this motion, they are lucky if the ball goes over the net, much less into the service box. Practice makes perfect, or at least better. Unfortunately, some of life's most important decisions do not come with many opportunities to practice. Most students choose a college only once. Outside of Hollywood, most of us choose a spouse, well, not more than 2 or 3 times. Few of us get to try many different careers. And outside of science fiction, we get one chance to save for retirement, though we can make some adjustments along the way. Generally, the higher the stakes, the less often we are able to practice. Most of us buy houses and cars not more than once or twice a decade, but we are really practiced at grocery shopping. Most families have mastered the art of milk inventory control, not by solving the relevant mathematical equation, but through trial and error. None of this is to say that the government should be telling people whom to marry or what to study. This is a book about libertarian paternalism. At this stage, we want to stress that rare, difficult choices are good candidates for nudges. Feedback. Even practice does not make perfect if people lack good opportunities for learning. Learning is most likely if people get immediate, clear feedback after each try. Suppose you are practicing your putting skills on the practice green. If you hit 10 balls toward the same hole, it is easy to get a sense of how hard you have to hit the ball. Even the least talented golfers will soon learn to gauge distance under these circumstances. Suppose instead you were putting the golf balls, but not getting to see where they were going. In that environment, you could putt all day and never get any better. Alas, many of life's choices are like practicing putting without being able to see where the balls end up, and for one simple reason. The situation is not structured to provide good feedback. For example, we usually get feedback only on the options we select, not the ones we reject. Unless people go out of their way to experiment, they may never learn about alternatives to the familiar ones. If you take the long route home every night, you may never learn there is a shorter one. Long-term processes rarely provide good feedback. Someone can eat a high-fat diet for years without having any warning signs until the heart attack. When feedback does not work, we may benefit from a nudge. Knowing what you like. Most of us have a good sense of whether we prefer coffee ice cream to vanilla, Frank Sinatra to Bob Dylan, and mysteries to science fiction. These are examples for which we have had the time to sample the alternatives and to learn about our tastes. But suppose you have to forecast your preferences for the unfamiliar, such as dining for the first time in a country with an exotic cuisine. Smart tourists often rely on others, waiters, for example, for help. Most foreigners like X and hate Y. Even in less exotic locales, it can be smart to let someone else choose for you. Two of the best restaurants in Chicago, Alinea and Charlie Trotter's, give their diners the fewest choices. At Alinea, diners just decide whether they want 15 very small plates or 25 tiny ones. At Charlie Trotter's, the diner is asked only whether to limit the dining to vegetables or not. In both, one is asked about dietary restrictions and allergies. The benefit of having so little choice is that the chef is authorized to cook you things you would never have thought to order. It is particularly hard for people to make good decisions when they have trouble translating the choices they face into the experiences they will have. A simple example is ordering a dish from a menu in a language you do not understand. But even when you do know the meaning of the words being used, you may not be able to translate the alternatives you are considering into terms that make the slightest sense to you. Take the problem of choosing a mutual fund for your retirement portfolio. Most investors, including us, would have trouble knowing how to compare a capital appreciation fund with a dynamic dividend fund, and even if the use of those words were made comprehensible, the problem would not be solved. What an investor needs to know is how a choice between those funds affects her spending power during retirement under various scenarios, something even an expert armed with a good software package and complete knowledge of the portfolios held by each fund can have trouble analyzing. The same problem arises for the choice among health plans. We may have little understanding of the effects of our selection. If your daughter gets a rare disease, will she be able to see a good specialist? How long will she have to wait in line? When people have a hard time predicting how their choices will end up affecting their lives, they have less to gain by numerous options and perhaps even by choosing for themselves. A nudge might be welcomed. Markets, a mixed verdict. The discussion thus far suggests that people may most need a good nudge for choices that have delayed effects, those that are difficult, infrequent, and offer poor feedback, and those for which the relation between choice and experience is ambiguous. A natural question is whether free markets can solve people's problems, even under such circumstances. Often market competition will do a lot of good, but in some cases, companies have a strong incentive to cater to people's frailties and to exploit them. Notice first that many insurance products have all the fraught features that we have sketched. The benefits from holding the insurance are delayed, the probability of having a claim is hard to analyze. Consumers do not get useful feedback on whether they are getting a good return on their insurance purchases, and the mapping from what they are buying to what they are getting can be ambiguous. But the insurance market is competitive, so a natural question to ask is whether market forces can be relied upon to solve the problem of fraught choices. Let's imagine two different worlds. In one world, econ world, all the consumers are econs and they have no problem with difficult choices. All quantitative decisions, including insurance purchases, are a piece of cake for them. Econs are part actuary. The other world is called human world, and in this world some of the consumers are humans who have all the features that generally characterize the tribe, while the rest are econs. In both worlds, there are well-functioning markets and at least some perfectly rational firms that have hired econs as managers. The key question is whether the insurance purchases in human world will be the same as the ones in econ world. In other words, do well-functioning markets render the humanness of the humans irrelevant? To analyze this question, let's start with a simple example inspired by the wonderful poem by Shel Silverstein, 1974, entitled Smart. The poem is fun as well as brilliant, so if you have a computer nearby, we suggest you type Smart and Shel Silverstein into Google and read the poem now. We will wait for you to get back before continuing. For those of you reading this on a plane, or too lazy to get up out of bed, the poem's tale is simple. The child narrator explains that his father gave him a dollar bill, which he wisely traded for 2 quarters because he, unlike his dumb trading partners, knows that 2 is more than 1. He continues trading, the 2 quarters for 3 dimes, 3 dimes for 4 nickels, and finally 4 nickels for 5 pennies. Finally, the son comes back to his father to report on his series of brilliant trades. When he does so, he reports that his father was too proud of him to speak. Suppose that some humans in a well-functioning market economy prefer 2 quarters to $1 because 2 is more than 1. What happens to these quarter lovers? Are they harmed? And do they influence market prices? The answers to these questions depend a bit on how dumb the quarter lovers are, but let's suppose that while they prefer 2 quarters to $1, they still prefer more quarters to fewer quarters, since they love quarters. That means that while they would, in principle, be willing to trade 2 quarters for $1, they won't have to do that because banks, among others, will compete for their business and will be happy to give them 4 quarters for $1. Of course, the quarter lovers will think that they're getting a great deal on this trade, but as long as there is competition in the provision of quarters, quarters will still sell for 25 cents and the irrational love of quarters will be essentially harmless to those who have this affliction. The example is obviously an extreme one, but many markets are not so different from this situation. Most of the time, competition ensures that price serves as a good signal of quality. Usually, but not always, the $50 bottles of wine are better than the $20 bottles, and the irrational consumers will not alter the market as long as they do not predominate. So if some people choose wine by how much they like the label, they will not be harmed, but if many people start to do that, then wine with attractive labels will be overpriced. For irrational consumers to be protected, there has to be competition. Sometimes that competition does not exist. Consider the case of extended warranties on small appliances, typically a bad deal for consumers. To take a specific hypothetical example, suppose that a cell phone costs $200. The cell phone has a free warranty for the first year, but the cell phone company offers, for $20, an extended warranty for the second year of the phone's life. After that, the consumer plans to buy a new phone. Suppose that the chance that the phone will break during the second year is 1%, so on average, consumers will get $2 worth of benefits from having this policy, but the price of the extended warranty is $20 in order to include a normal profit to the insurer and a kickback, or commission, to the salesperson at the cell phone store. Of course, econs understand all this and thus do not purchase extended warranties. But humans want extended warranties, perhaps because the salesman offers the friendly advice that the extended warranty is a good idea, or perhaps because they mistakenly think that cell phones break 15% of the time rather than 1%, or perhaps because they just think that it's better to be safe than sorry. What happens? Do market forces drive these unduly expensive extended warranties from the market? Or does competition drive the price of the extended warranties down to $2, the expected value of the claims? The answers to these questions are no and no. Before we explain, notice that extended warranties are plentiful in the real world and that many people buy them. Hint: don't. On our assumptions, the extended warranty is a product that simply should not exist. If humans realized that they were paying $20 for $2 worth of insurance, they would not buy the insurance. But if they do not realize this, markets cannot and will not unravel the situation. Competition will not drive the price down, in part because it takes the salesperson a while to persuade someone to pay $20 for $2 worth of insurance, and in part because it is difficult for third parties to enter this market efficiently. You might think that firms could educate people not to buy the warranty, and indeed they might. But why should firms do that? If you are buying something that you shouldn't, how do I make any money persuading you not to buy it? There is a general point here. If consumers have a less than fully rational belief, firms often have more incentive to cater to that belief than to eradicate it. When many people were still afraid of flying, it was common to see airline flight insurance sold at airports at exorbitant prices. There were no booths in airports selling people advice not to buy such insurance. In many markets, firms will be competing for the same consumers, but will be offering products that are not merely different, but that directly oppose each other. Some firms sell cigarettes, others sell products that help you quit smoking. Some firms sell fast food, others sell diet advice. If all consumers are econs, then there is no reason to worry about which of these competing interests wins. But if some of the consumers are humans who sometimes make bad choices, as judged by themselves, of course, then all of us may have an interest in which set of firms wins the battle. Government can, of course, outlaw some kinds of activities, but as libertarian paternalists we prefer a nudge, and we are keenly aware that governments are populated by humans. What can be done to help? In the next chapter we describe our primary tool, choice architecture. Chapter 5, Choice Architecture. Early in Thaler's career, he was teaching a class on managerial decision-making to business school students. Students would sometimes leave class early to go for job interviews, or a golf game, and would try to sneak out of the room as surreptitiously as possible. Unfortunately for them, the only way out of the room was through a large double door in the front, in full view of the entire class, though not directly in Thaler's line of sight. The doors were equipped with large, handsome wood handles, vertically mounted cylindrical pulls about 2 feet in length. When the students came to these doors, they were faced with two competing instincts. One instinct says that to leave a room you push the door. The other instinct says, when faced with large wooden handles that are obviously designed to be grabbed, you pull. It turns out that the latter instinct trumps the former, and every student leaving the room began by pulling on the handle. Alas, the door opened outward. At one point in the semester, Thaler pointed this out to the class, as one embarrassed student was pulling on the door handle while trying to escape the classroom. Thereafter, as a student got up to leave, the rest of the class would eagerly wait to see whether the student would push or pull. Amazingly, most still pulled. Their automatic system triumphed. The signal emitted by that big wooden handle simply could not be screened out. And when Thaler would leave that room on other occasions, he sheepishly found himself pulling too. Those doors are bad architecture because they violate a simple psychological principle with a fancy name, stimulus-response compatibility. The idea is that you want the signal you receive, the stimulus, to be consistent with the desired action. When there are inconsistencies, performance suffers and people blunder. Consider, for example, the effect of a large red octagonal sign that said, "Go." The difficulties induced by such incompatibilities are easy to show experimentally. One of the most famous such demonstrations is the Stroop, 1935, test. In the modern version of this experiment, people see words flashed on a computer screen and they have a very simple task. They press the right button if they see a word that is displayed in red, and press the left button if they see a word displayed in green. People find the task easy and can learn to do it very quickly with great accuracy. That is, until they are thrown a curveball in the form of the word green displayed in red, or in the word red displayed in green. For these incompatible signals, response time slows and error rates increase. A key reason is that the automatic system reads the word faster than the color naming system can decide the color of the text. See the word green in red text, and the non-thinking automatic system rushes to press the left button which is, of course, the wrong one. You can try this for yourself. Just get a bunch of colored crayons and write a list of color names, making sure that most of the names are not the same as the color they are written in. Better yet, get a nearby kid to do this for you. Then name the color names as fast as you can. That is, read the words and ignore the color. Easy, isn't it? Now say the color that the words are written in as fast as you can, and ignore the word itself. Hard, isn't it? In tasks like this, automatic systems always win over reflective ones. Although we have never seen a green stop sign, doors such as the ones described above are commonplace, and they violate the same principle. Flat plates say, push me, and big handles say, pull me, so don't expect people to push big handles. This is a failure of architecture to accommodate basic principles of human psychology. Life is full of products that suffer from such defects. Isn't it obvious that the largest buttons on a television remote control should be the power, channel, and volume controls? Yet how many remotes do we see that have the volume control the same size as the input control button, which if pressed accidentally can cause the picture to disappear? It is possible, however, to incorporate human factors into design, as Don Norman's wonderful book, The Design of Everyday Things, 1990, illustrates. One of the best examples is the design of a basic four-burner stove, figure 5.1. Most such stoves have the burners in a symmetric arrangement, as in the stove pictured at the top, with the controls arranged in a linear fashion below. In this setup, it is easy to get confused about which knob controls the front burner and which controls the back, and many pots and pans have been burned as a result. The other two designs we have illustrated are only two of many better possibilities. Norman's basic lesson is that designers need to keep in mind that the users of their objects are humans who are confronted every day with myriad choices and cues. The goal of this chapter is to develop the same idea for choice architects. If you indirectly influence the choices other people make, you are a choice architect. And since the choices you are influencing are going to be made by humans, you will want your architecture to reflect a good understanding of how humans behave. In particular, you will want to ensure that the automatic system doesn't get all confused. In this chapter, we offer some basic principles of good and bad choice architecture. Defaults, padding the path of least resistance. For reasons we have discussed, many people will take whatever option requires the least effort or the path of least resistance. Recall the discussion of inertia, status quo bias, and the yeah, whatever heuristic. All these forces imply that if, for a given choice, there is a default option, an option that will obtain if the chooser does nothing, then we can expect a large number of people to end up with that option, whether or not it is good for them. And as we have also stressed, these behavioral tendencies toward doing nothing will be reinforced if the default option comes with some implicit or explicit suggestion that it represents the normal or even the recommended course of action. Defaults are ubiquitous and powerful. They are also unavoidable in the sense that for any node of a choice architecture system, there must be an associated rule that determines what happens to the decision maker if she does nothing. Of course, usually the answer is that if I do nothing, nothing changes. Whatever is happening continues to happen. But not always. Some dangerous machines, such as chainsaws and lawnmowers, are designed with dead man switches, so that once you are no longer gripping the machine, it stops. When you leave your computer alone for a while to answer a phone call, nothing is likely to happen until you have talked for a long time, at which point the screensaver comes on, and if you neglect the computer long enough, it may lock itself. Of course, you can choose how long it takes before your screensaver comes on, but implementing that choice takes some action. Your computer probably came with a default time lag and a default screensaver. Chances are, those are the settings you still have. Many organizations in both the public and the private sector have discovered the immense power of default options. Successful businesses certainly have. Remember the idea of automatic renewal for magazine subscriptions? If renewal is automatic, many people will subscribe, for a long time, to magazines they don't read. Business offices at most magazines are aware of that fact. When you download a new piece of software, you will often have numerous choices to make. Do you want the regular or custom installation? Normally, one of the boxes is already checked, indicating it is the default. Which boxes do the software suppliers check? Two different motives are readily apparent: helpful and self-serving. In the helpful category would be making the regular installation the default if most users will have trouble with the custom installation. In the self-serving category would be making the default a willingness to receive emails with information about new products. In our experience, most software comes with helpful defaults regarding the type of installation, but may come with self-serving defaults on other choices. We will have more to say about motives later. For now, note that not all defaults are selected to make the chooser's life easier or better. The choice of the default can be quite controversial. Here is one example. An obscure portion of the No Child Left Behind Act requires that school districts supply the names, addresses, and telephone numbers of students to the recruiting offices of branches of the armed forces. However, the law stipulates that a secondary school student or the parent of the student may request that the student's name, address, and telephone listing not be released without prior written parental consent, and the local educational agency or private school shall notify parents of the option to make a request and shall comply with any request. Some school districts, such as Fairport, New York, interpreted this law as allowing them to implement an opt-in policy. That is, parents were notified that they could elect to make their children's contact information available, but if they did not do anything, this information would be withheld. This reading of the law did not meet with the approval of then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. The Defense and Education Departments sent a letter to school districts asserting that the law required an opt-out implementation. Only if parents actively requested that the contact information on their children be withheld would that option apply. In typical bureaucratic language, the departments contended that the relevant laws do not permit LEAs, local educational agencies, to institute a policy of not providing the required information unless a parent has affirmatively agreed to provide the information. Both the Defense Department and the school districts realized that opt-in and opt-out policies would lead to very different outcomes. Not surprisingly, much hue and cry ensued. We discuss a similarly touchy subject involving defaults in our chapter on organ donations. We have emphasized that default rules are inevitable, that private institutions and the legal system cannot avoid choosing them. In some cases, though not all, there is an important qualification to this claim. A choice architect can force the choosers to make their own choice. We call this approach required choice or mandated choice. In the software example, required choice would be implemented by leaving all the boxes unchecked and by requiring that at every opportunity one of the boxes be checked in order for people to proceed. In the case of the provision of contact information to the military recruiters, one could imagine a system in which all students, or their parents, are required to fill out a form indicating whether they want to make their contact information available. For emotionally charged issues like this one, such a policy has considerable appeal, because people might not want to be defaulted into an option that they might hate, but fail to reject because of inertia, or real or apparent social pressure. We believe that a required choice, favored by many who like freedom, is sometimes the best way to go. But consider two points about that approach. First, humans will often consider required choice to be a nuisance or worse, and would much prefer to have a good default. In the software example, it is really helpful to know what the recommended settings are. Most users do not want to have to read an incomprehensible manual in order to determine what arcane setting to elect. When choice is complicated and difficult, people might greatly appreciate a sensible default. It is hardly clear that they should be forced to choose. Second, required choosing is generally more appropriate for simple yes or no decisions than for more complex choices. At a restaurant, the default option is to take the dish as the chef usually prepares it, with the option to ask that certain ingredients be added or removed. In the extreme, required choosing would imply that the diner has to give the chef the recipe for every dish she orders. When choices are highly complex, required choosing may not be a good idea. It might not even be feasible. Expect error. Humans make mistakes. A well-designed system expects its users to err and is as forgiving as possible. Some examples from the world of real design illustrate this point. In the Paris subway system, Les Metro users insert a paper card the size of a movie ticket into a machine that reads the card, leaves a record on the card that renders it used, and then spits it out from the top of the machine. The cards have a magnetic strip on one side but are otherwise symmetric. On Thaler's first visit to Paris, he was not sure how to use the system, so he tried putting the card in with the magnetic strip face up and was pleased to discover that it worked. He was careful thereafter to insert the card with the strip face up. Many years and trips to Paris later, he was proudly demonstrating to a visiting friend the correct way to use the metro system when his wife started laughing. It turns out that it doesn't matter which way you put the card into the machine. In stark contrast to Le Metro is the system used in most Chicago parking garages. When entering the garage, you put your credit card into a machine that reads it and remembers you. Then when leaving, you must insert the card again into another machine at the exit. This involves reaching out of the car window and inserting the card into a slot. Because credit cards are not symmetric, there are four possible ways to put the card into the slot. Face up or down, strip on the right or left. Exactly one of those ways is the right way. And in spite of a diagram above the slot, it is very easy to put the card in the wrong way. And when the card is spit back out, it is not immediately obvious what caused the card to be rejected or to recall which way it was inserted the first time. Both of us have been stuck for several painful minutes behind some idiot who was having trouble with this machine, and have to admit to having occasionally been the idiot that is making all the people behind him start honking. Over the years, automobiles have become much friendlier to their human operators. If you do not buckle your seatbelt, you are buzzed. If you are about to run out of gas, a warning sign appears and you might be beeped. If you need an oil change, your car might tell you. Many cars come with an automatic switch for the headlights that turns them on when you are operating the car and off when you are not, eliminating the possibility of leaving your lights on overnight and draining your battery. But some error-forgiving innovations are surprisingly slow to be adopted. Take the case of the gas tank cap. On any sensible car, the gas cap is attached by a piece of plastic, so that when you remove the cap, you cannot possibly drive off without it. Our guess is that this bit of plastic cannot cost more than 10 cents. Once some firm had the good idea to include this feature, what excuse can there ever have been for building a car without one? Leaving the gas cap behind is a special kind of predictable error psychologists call a post-completion error. The idea is that when you have finished your main task, you tend to forget things relating to previous steps. Other examples include leaving your ATM card in the machine after getting your cash, or leaving the original in the copy machine after getting your copies. Most ATMs, but not all, no longer allow this error because you get your card back immediately. Another strategy, suggested by Norman, is to use what he calls a forcing function, meaning that in order to get what you want, you have to do something else first. So if in order to get your cash, you have to remove your card, you will not forget to do so. Another automobile-related bit of good design involves the nozzles for different varieties of gasoline. The nozzles that deliver diesel fuel are too large to fit into the opening on cars that use gasoline, so it is not possible to make the mistake of putting diesel fuel into your gasoline-powered car, though it is still possible to make the opposite mistake. The same principle has been used to reduce the number of errors involving anesthesia. One study found that human error, rather than equipment failure, caused 82% of the critical incidents. A common error was that the hose for one drug was hooked up to the wrong delivery port, so the patient received the wrong drug. This problem was solved by designing the equipment so that the gas nozzles and connectors were different for each drug. It became physically impossible to make this previously frequent mistake. A major problem in healthcare is called drug compliance. Many patients, especially the elderly, are on medicines they must take regularly and in the correct dosage. So here is a choice architecture question. If you are designing a drug and you have complete flexibility, how often would you want your patients to have to take their medicine? If we rule out a one-time dose administered immediately by the doctor, which would be the best on all dimensions but is often technically infeasible, then the next best solution is a medicine taken once a day, preferably in the morning. It is clear why once a day is better than twice or more a day, because the more often you have to take the drug, the more opportunities you have to forget. But frequency is not the only concern. Regularity is also important. Once a day is much better than once every other day, because the automatic system can be educated to think, my pills every morning when I wake up. Taking the pill becomes a habit, and habits are controlled by the automatic system. By contrast, remembering to take your medicine every other day is beyond most of us.